On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we've talked about BGP in the past and how it has its weaknesses. We'll go through those as well as how can organizations actually combat them. Plus, why are consumers and SMBs likely to fall to coronavirus scams? Well, Curtis is going to take us through it. Plus, Brian Curtis and I talk with a great guest, Dhruv Jain, Senior Director of Security Product Marketing at VMware, about security and hypervisors. Shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 390, recorded April 24th, 2020. Hypervisor security with VMware. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, it's always great to have you back. How are things going down there in Florida?
Well, it's been a stormy, rainy day here in Florida, but as we like to say down here, we need the rain. So we'll count it as a good day and, well, the sort of weather that really contributes to a general willingness to shelter in place.
Indeed, indeed. Now, how are things changing for you week over week? Is it any different than the week before?
Oddly enough, it's changing very little. You have to understand that I have primarily worked from a home office since the early 1990s. Mm. And at Dark Reading, our entire team is distributed and working from home offices. So from a very real point of view, it's meant practically no difference in our day-to-day routine. Most of the difference has come in the people that we are having contact with out in the industry. One of the things that I'm finding is that many more people want to have video conferences these days, and so I'm trying to accommodate them. And on a personal level, one of the things I'm finding is that my friends from all around the world are touching base much more frequently. I'm regularly having conversations either via Zoom or Skype or over one messenger service or another with friends in Europe, in China, in the Middle East. And it's both very heartwarming and a little worrying to see the desperate need that people still have to reach out and touch another human being.
All right. I get that. Well, thanks for being here, Chris. Really appreciate that. Well, of course, our next co-host is no stranger to challenges in the enterprise. And, of course, he's our very own Mr. Brian McHenry, Director of Global Solution Architect over F5 Networks. Bam, great to have you back. How are things going over there in the East Coast?
A little rainy, just like Curtis up here in New Jersey. But
you're feeling the Seattle weather finally, huh?
Yeah, Seattle weather from my friends back in the F5 mothership in Seattle HQ. We had a fun thing yesterday in the world of the pandemic. We did a virtual bring your kid to work day, which I, like Curtis, I've been working from home for the last 12 years. So for 12 years, bring your kid to work day has been, hey kids, come look at my desk that you've seen a million times. Right. But yesterday we actually had a bunch of virtual events run by F5 employees, you know, talking to kids about what it's like to be an engineer. Another one was a virtual Minecraft tour of our new F5 tower headquarters. So I was kind of delighted to be able to kind of have my kids interact. And even though my kids are both teenagers and high schoolers and a little bit jaded, they both got to interact with F5 employees in and around like the things that we do at work every day, and you know, meet some of the people that, you know, they never get to meet. So pretty neat, you know, sort of upbeat thing that's happening now during the pandemic.
Right. Well, I can definitely tell you working from home is a new challenge for me. I've never done it before. I literally have my office in the corner of a room where my kids do Legos, and so I get handed things like this in the middle of my show. I work at Microsoft. They decided this would be fancy for me to have during my meetings, and so that's the kind of things I have to do and deal with during my meetings. It's fun. But, you know, let's go ahead and get started with the show, because I know we have a lot to cover. Not only have we talked about BGP in the past, but it's a weak link in today's internet routes, and we're going to get into how organizations like Cloudflare are trying to help organizations combat the challenges there. Plus, why are consumers and SMBs likely to fall for coronavirus scams? Well, we'll discuss that and actually go into detail with that with the crew here. Of course, we also have a really great guest, Dhruv Jain, Senior Director of Security Product Marketing at VMware, to talk security and hypervisors, of course. But first, this week we had a lot of enterprise news, so let's go ahead and get into this week's blips. Nowadays, people are looking for answers. We all are. It's been frustrating to some people about the lack of universal access to coronavirus research articles and how it's become a cause of concern, especially for the medical and scientific communities in the developing world. Now, those fighting to treat COVID-19 are undermanned, they're undersupplied, and they're overwhelmed by the virus impact and the lack of resources available to understand it. Now, many have begun to ask why potentially life-saving research is being hidden behind pricey paywalls. Now, in the academic community, paywalls exist primarily as a way for publishers to pay for marketing, formatting, and distributions of scholarly articles. Plus, publishers also claim that paywalls serve to free academics from their demands of the market. Now, publishing companies have concern that without paywalls, there would be a heightened possibility of corruption and exploitation. In fact, researchers could be forced into topics and findings which validate political or social learnings, thus eliminating academic integrity. On the flip side, paywalls, unfortunately, which require paid subscription or even access to a university, block access to scientific research and make significant amount of money doing so. The paid publishing of these articles is a multi-billion dollar industry, with top publishers boasting a profit margin between 35% to 40%. Now, the articles are priced at a rate far too expensive for the average consumer. In fact, oftentimes upwards of $50 each. Now, schools and universities are forced to spend millions of dollars per year for subscriptions to these archives. Now, this is not going to stop the so-called Robin Hoods of science. That's right. A hacker by the name of Shrine found it absurd that thousands of studies on the coronavirus were hidden behind the paywalls and accessible only to those who could afford them. In fact, Shrine found and illegally downloaded more than 5,000 coronavirus research papers created from 1968 through 2020, now using a website called Sci-Hub. He then released all the articles on Reddit and within hours had thousands of seeders accessing the research. Now, attempting to make this his vigilante operation to make it more legitimate, Shrine tried to appeal directly to the publishing companies themselves by creating a petition on change.org asking them to remove the paywalls in order to help individuals and organizations research the coronavirus themselves. Now, while Shrine's Reddit post was obviously illegal here, he believes the practice of hiding valuable information behind expensive paywalls is what's really unethical. Recent history also points to the danger of these paywalls during the times of crisis. What do you guys think?
Well, white hat hackers are helping to fold COVID-19 proteins. Some 200 security experts, including former members of the famed 1990s era hacking collective Loft, Metasploit creator H.D. Moore, and Black Cat and DEF CON founder Jeff Moss, are donating their computing power, including some password cracking processors and gaming systems, to help run simulations of the dynamics of COVID-19 virus proteins. The effort is part of the so-called Folding at Home project that for 20 years has been employing crowdsourced computer processing power to help run molecular calculations for diseases including cancer and Alzheimer's, and most recently, of course, COVID-19. To date, there are some 100,000 participants who Folding at Home calls citizen scientists, and the goal is to come up with therapies for the diseases based on the research. Folding at Home is based out of the School of Medicine at Washington University in St. Louis, with support from its other main labs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and Temple University. Now, for those who don't know, folding is basically the process of assembling a protein, and simulating that process takes massive CPU and GPU power so scientists can more closely study how proteins misfold and therefore cause disease processes. The team will jokingly refer to its efforts as virus protection by questionable botnets, a reference to the way the crowdsourced network of computing power is pooled for the project. Of course, one big difference is that it's not illegal like a botnet. Bruce Schneer, who has been promoting the concept of security experts using their hacking skills in the public interest, notes that the Folding at Home project is, quote, a socially beneficial project that wants your computing resources, end quote. You have to trust them and their code, of course, but that's true for any code you download and run on your computer, he says. The security team of Rootfolds is looking for more participants to join its team with computing power. To sign up, download the Folding at Home client software and enter the team ID, get ready, of 258-829. That's 258-829.
During the Federal Communication Commission's monthly meeting yesterday, it ratified unlicensed use of the 6 gigahertz radio frequency spectrum in the USA. This decision opens the way for the proposed Wi-Fi 6E standard to move forward. Industry giants Intel and Broadcom began planning for this move more than 2 years ago. Broadcom released its first Wi-Fi 6E chipset in February, targeted at mobile devices like smartphones and tablets. Intel hasn't released any actual products using it yet, but in discussions with Ars Technica, an Intel rep confirmed that they're on the way. Intel's spokesperson said that the company's own working prototype devices were part of the presentations originally given to the FCC to facilitate the decision-making process, and described Intel's and Broadcom's work on devices prior to the FCC's decision as a risky but rewarding two-year investment on both companies' part. Previously licensed use of the 6 gigahertz spectrum includes point-to-point microwave backhaul used by commercial wireless providers, telephone and utility communication, and control links. It also includes cable television relay links, which are mobile links used by newscasters doing on-site live reporting, and radio astronomy. The truly excellent news for Wi-Fi 6E backers and future users is that the FCC has ratified unlicensed use of the entire 1.2 gigahertz spectrum for low-power indoor devices. Separating unlicensed outdoor and high-powered usage from indoor and low-power allows for the maximum utility of spectrum in the most common and most crowded Wi-Fi environments, while preserving the utility of incumbent licensed users. While there has been much debate about whether low-power internet can cause interference to fixed networks, electronics, news gathering, and other incumbent uses, the studies and the records are quite clear. Unlicensed use with the technical rules set in this item can be introduced without causing harmful interference. Commissioner Jeffrey Starks points out that even those who aren't early adopters of Wi-Fi 6E technology stand to benefit, since those who do will compete less for available 5 gigahertz spectrum. The FCC's vote to ratify unlicensed 6 gigahertz use was bipartisan and unanimous, with support statements made by organizations including the Internet and Television Association, Charter, Comcast, Public Knowledge, and the Wi-Fi Alliance. With general use of 6 gigahertz secured, the FCC expects to see tremendous offloads to current mobile traffic to local Wi-Fi. Commissioner O'Reilly cited a Wi-Fi forward assessment when claiming that 76% of all mobile traffic will be offloaded to Wi-Fi in the next 2 years. With usable rules for unlicensed 6 gigahertz spectrum use defined, expect to see Wi-Fi 6E devices beginning to become available to consumers in late 2020 or early 2021.
Now, what if your organization's emails and passwords were leaked to the public? Now, how damaging would it be? Well, according to the Site Intelligence Group, which actually monitors online extremism and terrorist groups, several well-known organizations have had their people's data leaked to the wild. Now, according to the group, 25,000 email addresses and passwords allegedly belonging to the National Institutes of Health, the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, and other groups working to combat the coronavirus pandemic have been leaked. Now, it's been hard to verify how effective or real these credentials might be, but based on some of the cursory looks, it looks like the World Health Organization's information seems to be valid. Now, the lists of user credentials whose origins are unclear appear to have first been posted to Pastebin, a text storage site. Now, a link to the material was then posted to 4chan, a message board notorious for its hateful and extreme political commentary, and later to Twitter and far-right extremist channels on Telegram, a message again. Now, white supremacists capitalized on the lists and published them aggressively across their venues. Using the data, far-right extremists were calling for harassment campaigns while sharing conspiracy theories about the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the distribution of these alleged email credentials were just another part of the months-long initiative across the far right to weaponize the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, although none of the organizations have found a breach of data at this point, at least they haven't said so, they seem to all be monitoring the situation and following through with security reviews. Now, if this show says anything, is that multi-factor authentication will definitely render these types of leaks almost invalid. So take some time, review your security policies, and make sure you too are using MFA.
IBM has announced the general availability of IBM Cloud Data Shield, a service built to better protect business applications while information is at rest, in transit, and in use. The platform, developed in a partnership with Fortinix, relies on confidential computing, a technology gaining traction as more organizations seek new ways to secure their sensitive data in the cloud. Cloud Data Shield lets users run containerized applications in a secure enclave on an IBM Cloud Kubernetes service host. The service supports user-level code to allocate enclaves, which are protected from processes running at higher levels of privilege. During the year-long beta period, the team learned about client requirements to run different languages. As a result, they expanded the language capabilities. Fortinix runs time encryption OS lets containerized applications run in the secure enclaves with no code change and supports languages including C, C++, Python, and Java. Now, questions remain about how comfortable businesses are with the secure enclave technology, which is a more secure architecture, but still relatively young. Still, confidential computing is based on principles of isolation, sandboxing, and trusted platform modules that have each been around for a long, long time.
Mirai COVID variant is disregarding stay-at-home orders. Mirai is an IoT botnet F5 Labs researchers have been tracking since 2016. It infamously took down large sections of the internet in that year and has remained active ever since. Its source code was released online in September 2016, enabling unskilled attackers to create a massive malicious botnet with relative ease. Mirai continues to target our IoT devices using the same tactics as before to attack and harness the collective power of millions of unprotected devices to launch DDoS attacks. It does not usually spread through traditional phishing attempts, but acts as a self-propagating worm that searches for and attacks vulnerable servers. Although small changes have been made to this malware, malicious actors now appear to have taken advantage of public interest in the coronavirus, aka COVID-19, by naming their latest variant file, cleverly enough, COVID. This sample, which is detailed in the article, is publicly available, and F5 Labs researchers detected this new Mirai variant. It appears that the authors did not make any attempt to remake the malware or create new exploits. The sample was spotted with two different hashes that multiple antivirus engines can detect and identify. Both samples are named COVID and have different file extensions. For a table of the indicators of compromise, or IOCs, for this sample, check out the article on f5labs.com. Threat monitoring tools noted that the IP address associated with this malware is a hostwin's domain. Now, the whois information is hidden, but the paths from the sample are provided in the F5 Labs article as well, and for those seeking to perform their own additional analysis. Interestingly, in this sample, The targets are pretty much the same as well. One of the targets is TeamSpeak, a voice communications app that gamers typically use. And the other is target is a Huawei router module. Now, Mirai focuses on TeamSpeak and Huawei because these systems have historically had vulnerabilities associated with default passwords, which is the main mechanism for spread of the Mirai botnet. Now, TeamSpeak is an especially choice target because it responds the responses to requests are larger than they request. So it can be used to conduct a rather large volumetric amplification DDoS attack. Now, while COVID-19 appeared to affect some groups of attackers who promised not to attack healthcare infrastructure, Mirai and other cybercriminal malware doesn't seem to be slowing down, with files explicitly named after the virus. This implies that malware authors continue to work despite the global pandemic. Along with these Mirai files, researchers noticed other malware families attempting to take advantage of the virus by renaming or adding features that reference COVID-19. And while this Mirai variant doesn't seem to use new exploits or techniques, it's important to note when malware morphs to try and take advantage of a trend or current event.
And there seems to be a continued amount of information around the security and privacy positions of the Zoom service. Now, it almost seems to be snowballing in the wild. Now, due to some remote positions, most have turned to apps like FaceTime, Teams, Skype, and other applications because they want to be out with friends, they want to take classes, they want to work via digital means. Now, while Zoom has become a major social platform during a stay-at-home orders, hackers have taken reliance on the popular video chatting app to breach privacy of thousands of users. Now, when things are popular, they always seem to become targets to attackers as well. Now, researchers found on Monday that hackers began selling over 500,000 Zoom accounts for less than 1 cent per account. Now, according to the findings from the cybersecurity firm Civil, which investigates and stops hacking initiatives, the company has found more than 500,000 Zoom accounts on a hacker forum and the dark web, and they have been put up for grabs for low prices, as reported by Bleeping Computer. Now, Civil, in the effort to stop the accounts from being sold online, was able to purchase about 530,000 accounts for well under a cent here, and each report on their findings. But how exactly are thousands of Zoom accounts being hacked so suddenly? Well, these hackers and hackings are not a traditional kind. Zoom accounts have been obtained using credential stuffing, which is when hackers use previously data breaches that include leaked username, email addresses, or passwords to get into the accounts. Now, those logins are then compiled into lists that are sold to hackers. Now, the suspected reason for these accounts being doled out by hackers come back to the digital attacks called Zoom bombing. Now, a new form of trolling and abuse, Zoom bombing actually entails people dropping in on Zoom calls that post violent content or harass others in the chat. Now, the FBI has stepped in here and has an ongoing investigation in the Internet Crime and Complaint Center. What can you do to combat this all? Well, MFA plus ensuring active software is installed. You host your private meetings only have private meetings here, and managing secure and screen sharing options to mitigate the dangers of online harassment. Follow the framework, and you too just might stay away from Zoom bombing explosions. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Think about it. Suddenly, you have dozens, hundreds, or maybe even thousands of employees working remotely. I know I do, and we all get tons of emails every day. Now, guess what? That also makes us vulnerable. Now, we are literally our own attack service. 91% of all cyber attacks start in email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking, you name it. Multiply that by how many employees you have times how many emails you get. One click on the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and even your reputation. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. Now, get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. Listen to what it includes. It has all-in-one email security, backup, and archiving. In fact, it uses AI-based protection to protect you from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise. And plus, they have automated incident responses, giving you options to quickly and efficiently address attacks. And they offer security awareness training to educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. Now, you might remember, we've covered this on Twilight before about the recent attacks and campaigns over email where attackers would impersonate organizations like the UN World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They trick users into opening malicious emails, and that's how they get in. That's right. Right now, there are attacks impersonating all these organizations, and attackers utilize these domain spoofing practices and promise information relating to the coronavirus in an attempt to trick users into phishing scams. They're on their way in. You need to protect yourself. Ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. That's barracuda.com/enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, sometimes your latency and sputter on the internet can be due more, they actually be due more towards not just your ISP, but something actually else in here. In fact, the most, in the case of recent Google and Facebook challenges, the culprit wasn't a hack or a bug. It was problems with the internet data routing standard known as the Border Gateway Protocol. Now, which BGP, obviously, you all know why, now, which had actually allowed significant amounts of web traffic to take an unexpected detour through a Russian telecom. Now, you may already be aware BGP issues and disruptions tend to happen frequently, and more often than not, they're actually generally by accident. But BGP can also be hijacked for large-scale spying, data interception, or as a sort of denial-of-service attack. But just last week, the United States executive branch agencies moved to block China Telecom from offering services in the U.S. because of allegedly maliciously activating an activity that includes BGP attacks. Now, companies like Cloudflare are sitting on the front lines here of the BGP blowback, and while the company can't fix the problem directly, it can call out those that are slow to contribute to the defenses. Now, Cloudflare is trying to combat the issues at the front lines. They actually recently launched a cool service called Is BGP Safe Yet? It's a site that makes it easier for anyone to check whether their internet service provider has added the security protections and filters that can make BGP more stable. Now, Cloudflare actually estimates that so far about half of the internet is more protected thanks to heavy hitters like AT&T, the Swedish telecom Telia, and the Japanese telecom NTT adopting BGP improvements. And while Cloudflare says it doesn't seem like the incident that happened just recently was intentional or malicious, but Russian telecoms do have a history of suspicious BGP meddling, and similar problems will keep cropping up until the whole industry is on board to the new security. Now, this brings up the questions. Are there tools and techniques to help better the situation and shield organizations from such mistakes and attacks? So I'm going to bring you guys in first. First, obviously, BGP is one of the things we talked about before. But Curtis, I'm going to throw this to you first. Can you maybe go for the audience, tell them a little bit about what BGP is and why it's essential for internet traffic?
Sure. BGP is one of these things that has been around for quite a long time, since 1994. And it really solves a critical problem. Let's all admit that in a perfect world, every node on the internet would connect to every other node. If you wanted to send packets to someplace across the world, you would just directly connect there. But that's not the way the reality works. The big question is, if I'm sending packets out, where do I send them next? Out of all of my neighbors, who gets traffic if I'm sending it out? The answer comes through BGP. The Border Gateway Protocol is something that's set up so that each node can know the most efficient, the most effective next step along the path. Now, there are plenty of places where in small instances this can be done automatically, but especially at the large scale, when you're talking about major international corporations, when you're talking about, well, things like corporations like Google or Amazon, or if you're talking major ISPs, what you end up with are human network operators, the BGP architects, who talk to one another about what's going on with their networks and how best to set things up. Now, problems can come over something on the other end. And that is if a particular node or set of nodes knows that it should be receiving traffic destined for a particular location, a particular address, it can advertise that fact and say, when you get to the end, send it all to me. So if you're going to, you know, abc.com, abc.com is somewhere in my network. So send all that traffic my way. Now, recall, this is different than the address. Addresses in BGP are different. Addresses say where the destination is. BGP is telling you how to get to the address. Problems have come about when people have typically accidentally, although not always, advertised themselves as being routes for destinations that are not, in fact, within their network. One of the most famous occasions was a year or so ago when everything destined for part of Google in North America ended up routing through a small African ISP. As you can imagine, this didn't work out well for either that ISP or all the people in North America trying to get to Google. It took about an hour to get things sorted out, propagated, and back on track. The thing is, BGP was designed and implemented in a world in which all of the major players within the internet knew and trusted one another. That's no longer the case, and so now we're ending up with a situation where engineers on the standards committee are having to go back and trying very hard to quickly backfill security onto BGP. I would say, given the way these things work, if we get a more secure BGP in the next couple of years, we'll be doing pretty darn well.
Indeed, we will. Now, before we get to that, I mean, obviously, we're not there yet. There are some companies like, for instance, Thousand Eyes is out there, used to be a sponsor here, that actively monitor BGP routes, but at a price, of course, and help alert to you whether things are going wrong. More of a active way to actually help you maybe reroute things. Now, I want to throw this over to Brian. Bam, is there any other ways to help with this? How can organizations combat this?
That's a good question. Monitoring is really the only way, right? Tools like Thousand Eyes, things that'll do path probing, tell you when suddenly a route to somewhere is taking way more hops or more latency than it ought to, or is traveling over service provider networks that you don't recognize, right? So proactive monitoring is a great way to let you know when something's gone wrong. Dig into a little bit more detail about what Cloudflare is actually trying to do, right? Is BGP safe yet, right? So this is similar to, is TLS fast yet? Is the internet HTTP2 yet? A lot of similar sorts of projects that monitor the adoption of newer protocols and more, in many cases, safer protocols. The closest example here is SSL Labs, right? Did a lot to raise awareness of just really, crappy SSL implementations, right? You go and you see the padlock in the browser and you think, oh, well, it's encrypted. It must be safe. And the reality is that until SSL Labs came along and then the browser vendors started to implement better indicators in the browser bar, nobody was really aware of what kind of encryption was actually going on. In many cases, using vulnerable older versions of SSL, like SSL v3 instead of more modern TLS 1.2, and as well as the Cypher suite. So carry that over to BGP and what Cloudflare is trying to do here. You go to is BGP safe yet? And you look up your ISP and you'll find out and they want you to tweet immediately, like, hey, my ISP is safe or not safe, because they haven't implemented what's called RPKI. So Kurt mentioned, hey, BGP exists based on implicit trust, right? I'm provider A and I trust provider B to advertise the right routes. And there's nothing really to stop a man in the middle to get in between and say, oh, here, look, go advertise this, and so it's fairly trivial to do so. what RPKI does is sort of give us a sort of 1.0, you know, SSL, right? It's back in, you know, very simple sort of mutual authentication where router A talks to router B and says, is this route advertisement been signed by you, essentially? And, you know, to give us at least some level of verification. So I'm not just taking in a route advertisement and just assuming it's fine because it comes from an IP address that I know. Which, you know, we know IP addresses are easily spoofed. So really that's what they're looking at. Now this only works if it goes to scale, right? If all the main ISPs adopt RPKI and make it possible for ISPs to trust each other, autonomous systems as they're known, to trust each other at large scale. So I think this is a really good initiative. I'm not sure I want general consumer users tweeting this type of information. They don't necessarily understand what they're tweeting for the most part. If you're talking about, you know, even a lot of network engineers don't necessarily work with BGP a lot. But anything that gets, you know, big organizations to move to a more secure standard, I tip my cap at trying to figure out something that works, because to date, you know, we've been stuck with this implicit trust that on the internet, implicit trust doesn't really work, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think that hopefully in the next couple of years, as you guys have both said, that this type of thing starts to be readily adopted. We'll have to see. Well, I do want to move on to the next bite. Curtis, I've been wondering this myself. Why are consumers and SMBs likely to fall to coronavirus scams?
Well, you know, this is a critical question because it's no secret that right now the fraudsters, the criminals, the general mischief makers are shifting their strategies to exploit fears related to COVID-19. Since the WHO declared its pandemic on March 11th, IBM X-Force has seen an increase of more than 6,000% in COVID-19-related spam. Phishing lures are aiming to manipulate people by impersonating the Small Business Administration, WHO, and U.S. banks offering relief funds. By the way, as we tape this, Congress passed a bill last night authorizing new funds, so we can expect a new wave of phishing emails focused on the new funds. Now, to learn how effective these scams are, IBM Security and Morning Consult polled over 2,000 small business owners and members of the general population in early April. The study that resulted from that, revealed many people lack an understanding of the way government officials communicate with the public and a misunderstanding of the resources that are available to small businesses and individuals. Now, despite years of warnings from the IRS, law enforcement, and the security community stating that the IRS will never email individuals about tax filings, 35% of the respondents said that is precisely how they would expect to receive IRS communications. Approximately a third expect the World Health Organization to send them an email. Overall, just shy of one half expect official information related to COVID-19 to arrive via email. More than half of small business owners also expect official virus-related information to arrive via email. Now, what's the big takeaway? It's that both individuals and small businesses are insufficiently skeptical about information that arrives via email. They are willing to engage with the email, and because they misunderstand how they might receive communication, they are all too willing to go deeper and deeper into the plots that the criminals have launched. Now, the threats are very similar for small businesses and consumers. Huge enterprise threats, they're something different. But small businesses and consumers are targets of general phishing emails. Now, before COVID-19, the spam and the phishing emails were all over the map in terms of their subject matter. It could be anything from the Nigerian prince looking to have you help him shelter money to information about taxes or fines or your Social Security account being suspended until you verify all of your information. Now, COVID-19, which is so much in the news, is also very much in the email boxes of potential victims. Now, these emails often include very realistic logos and spoofed websites. You know, one popular one mimics an American Express email, offers $2,400 in stimulus relief, but requires authentication to claim it. Another one comes from supposedly Wells Fargo and offers them a payment from another customer if they verify their account. It's one thing that's common in both of these. If any email address arrives promising money but saying that you or your company need to verify your information or authenticate who you are, either by replying to the email or going to a website that they give you the button for, the odds approach 100% that it's a scam. Just send it to the trash bin. You know, one of the things that we're finding, once upon a time, we used to say, well, let your cursor hover over a link. And the actual link in most email systems will pop up and show you. And you can frequently find something that's different than what you expect. That's a huge red flag. But as more and more people rely on their smartphones for email, the chance that they will fall for one of these scams goes up for two reasons. One, studies show that people just tend to believe things that hit their phones more than they believe things that hit their computers. And the second is that many of these techniques that we've talked about, like the hovering, just don't work. Pardon me. Now, consumers and small businesses aren't the only ones who are at risk. Government employees, national and international health organizations, and all of their employees have been victims. Google is saying that it is seeing a rise in the number of phishing and spam emails as well. It's a huge problem, and it's only going to get larger as we get deeper and deeper into this pandemic and our response to it. So I'm going to ask each of my co-hosts, and I'll start, Bam, with you. One of the things that is seen as a critical need is for, you know, a culture of skepticism or a culture of security. How do you do that, especially when you're talking about a small business where typically the level of trust is very high among both the employees and the suppliers and customers they work with?
Well, I think you can't always count on fixing humans, right? Particularly, you know, small business, the good news is that I don't have to address a lot of people. The bad news is, as you said, there's a lot of trust there. What I think I've seen be successful is in a small organization, you can leverage tools like Google's G Suite for your collaboration suite, which has a lot of security features built in and does a lot of that heavy lifting for you without you necessarily having to be an expert in security or have a cybersecurity person on staff. So I think one of the answers is leverage software as a service. Don't try to, you know, don't try this at home, essentially, right? Don't, you know, just because you're used to having like your own email and your own this and your own that, you want to definitely look for package services where the security is managed for you, where it's built in, it's part of the default posture. I don't think it's a good idea to rely on security awareness training or things of that nature. Most people are not going to change their behaviors unless they have a direct personally affecting experience, right? So the least tech savvy person is suddenly going to become security hyper aware the first time they accidentally download malware on their work machine or do something that causes a potential compromise. So I think you know, you can do all the security awareness training you want, but it still comes back to, for me, you know, looking for things, systems and services that are more secure by default, that don't rely on the user and don't, you know, essentially blame the victim or hold them responsible for their own security to whatever degree possible.
Well, Lou, I'm going to ask you next. We're sitting here, Bam just talked about things that automate the response for you and protect you when you can't protect yourself. You know, as you listen to this, as someone who is managing the development of software at different levels, how realistic is it to expect, say, a mail client or a mail system to protect employees from themselves when it comes to clicking on this? Is it the sort of thing that, you know, a big public email system can do? Or do we still need to train our employees not to go randomly clicking on links that come in?
I can definitely say that email systems should be possible, should be capable of doing these types of things. In fact, there are many, like for instance, Exchange Server does have this capability. And will it save us from ourselves? It can do a pretty good job. There's lots of spam filtering and malicious malware filtering, and it can also detect unusual activity. Are there sometimes false positives? Yes, but I can definitely tell you that these systems actually do a really good job. In fact, my inbox, whether it's on Gmail or Outlook or even at Microsoft, stays fairly clean. Like, they are able to filter through and sift through most of those things. And even when I went and go look at what they filtered out or sorted out, you can definitely tell that a lot of these things are, you know, kind of up in the air and don't make sense to be there. So using kind of machine learning and, evidence of different campaigns that are going through the wild are definitely good ways for systems like these to really help out your organization and the people in your organization to help filter this stuff out. So I definitely think that these types of systems should be able to help you, especially the email sense. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Now it comes to my favorite part of the show. We actually bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWI, right? And today we have Dhruv Jain, Senior Director of Security Product Marketing at VMware. Dhruv, great to have you on. Thank you for being here. Huge fan of VMware.
Thank you, Lou. Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Absolutely. Now, before we get in all the fun topics we have ahead here, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey of your through tech for you, technology, and how you ended up at VMware?
Sure. Before this, I was at Cisco, where I was building a security and network verification engine as a spin-in at Cisco. Very successful. And then before that, I had my own startup in the operations and analytics space. So been in tech for around 20 years, 15, 20 years in data center infrastructure. And security is the place to be.
Indeed it is. So maybe if you can take us through maybe why kind of the different position that VMware is taking on IT security. Do you think it's fundamentally broken? Is there things that need to be fixed, or is there a different way to kind of approach it?
Yeah, and that's a lot of questions in one. I'll sort of peel them one by one. You know, last year, if any of you, you heard Pat Gelsinger, CEO's keynote at RSA, he made a nice, provocative statement, right, that the security industry is broken. Right. And it's kind of true, right? It's become this incredibly sort of complex world with like 3,000-4,000 different products. And invariably, if you look at customers, their architectures are like, 70-80 security products in their environment. They're all bolted on top of each other. And the sprawl is creating just too many seams that attackers are actually getting through, right? They're coming through at the seams of these different products and the misconfigurations between them. And it's kind of become a platitude now that the only thing growing faster than security spend is the cost of security breaches, right? I mean, according to some stats I've seen, the average, you know, cost of a data breach in 2019 is almost hitting $4 million. And the more scary thing than that to me is the fact that attackers are dwelling like for 3-4 months on average inside the network and are coming in through the front doors, like with things that, you know, you guys were just talking about, phishing attacks, stolen credentials. They're coming in through the front door. So clearly this stuff is not working. And that's, you know, despite the fact that their complexity of their architecture is really, you know, reaching unmanageable levels. So it's not unreasonable to say things are broken and that the security industry at large is ripe for disruption and needs, you know, a new approach to security. And that's where we are trying to come in. And, you know, I can tell you more about the approach around intrinsic security, but yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's kind of where I was going to go next is, what are some of the approaches that, that people should actually take here? Absolutely. That's the natural segue.
Sure. You know, fundamentally, if I just give you a soundbite, it is, you know, VMware's strategy is about making security intrinsic to the infrastructure. And it's funny, I heard BAM use that word just like 5 minutes ago. But really what we want to do is make security, you know, inside the infrastructure that you're using inside, you know, the data center and the network infrastructure, the cloud, the endpoints, the users, and tie all of those with context so that there's rich context in each of these infrastructure elements. We want to bring that out, right? And as VMware, we have that infrastructure and we have that rich context that, you know, often most other products do not have. They have to guess it, they have to infer it. And, you know, of course, for this particular segment, you know, my focus at VMware is in network security. So, you know, find me biased a lot in my conversation around the network security component. But, you know, intrinsic security very broadly is sort of the approach that VMware is taking. And, you know, since you heard Pat last year at RSA, you know, VMware is obviously going big on security, right? We acquired, you heard us acquire Carbon Black. You know, middle of last year, sort of getting the market leader in next-gen AV EDR. Last year, we had announced the service-defined firewall, our internal firewall, and we can talk more about that. We acquired another company in the networking space and security space, RV Networks, which has load balancer and WAF. So we are continuing to expand on our portfolio around security to address these challenges.
Right. Well, before we get, because the firewall one's actually an interesting one. One question I had is more around firewalls and the fact that do you think that customers and consumers and organizations really need internal firewalls? Do you think that perimeter security is kind of dead here?
You know, I'm going to be controversial and say perimeter security is not dead, but it's appearing that it's like wholly insufficient. So you absolutely need it. But, you know, as they say, it's necessary but not sufficient, right, if you're a mathematician. So, you know, what's happening in the last several years, you know, if you think about what was, you know, our architectures 10 years ago, it was simple three-tier architectures, often monolithic apps. Traffic was mostly, you know, flowing north-south, right, headed for the internet. And it was fine to have a big fat firewall at the edge, inspect all your traffic, or even between your web and database tiers, stick a firewall in between, and that was good enough. But that's changed in the last 5-10 years, right? You've got all these new, you know, the perimeter's pretty much dissipated. You've got highly distributed applications. And today, even more so, as we are living in this remote workforce world, there is no perimeter. Like, we're all at home. Your applications are at the edges. They're highly distributed. Even inside the data center, it's not a three-tier application anymore. It's like tens, hundreds of microservices, talking to SaaS services and getting data back, talking to the cloud because, you know, I've got my app sitting in the cloud, the database sitting on-prem. So the apps are distributed. They're way more ephemeral. And so, you know, invariably our thesis and our belief is, you know, that invariably the attackers are going to compromise your perimeter, whatever that be. Right, they'll find that one point, that one weak link. You know, we've all heard of the retailer where they enter through the HVAC system and finally reach their way to the point of sale system. Or the credit agency hack where they came in through this, you know, unpatched Apache server sitting somewhere, and it's kind of a benign server, but then went on to make tens or, you know, 40 plus lateral moves to extract sensitive data. And literally that caused, you know, $3 to $4 billion of loss of market cap just overnight, when suddenly it came out that, you know, 100 million plus credit cards were gone, right? So East-West, you know, I kind of like to say East-West is the new new North-South, right? It's the new battleground, and right. You absolutely have to protect your East-West traffic.
Right. And then with these heterogeneous clouds out there, obviously a lot of organizations are going to this kind of hybrid cloud model. This kind of segues into my next question about the VMware service-defined firewalls. How are these helping, and are they applying to kind of the hybrid cloud type infrastructure architecture?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good question. So, you know, VMware, if you look at our strategy, it's absolutely this multi-cloud strategy, right? Across, you know, we support the public clouds, and especially with the firewall as well. And I can maybe take a couple of minutes to just explain what is the service-defined firewall and what is our view of what an internal firewall is. It sort of maps into your cloud question. If you think about traditional, you have the ability to put a physical appliance or a virtual appliance as your east-west firewall, but it's almost impractical to put it out at every service. And the amount of throughput that you're going to need is impractical. The management complexity becomes impractical. You know, you can probably manage tens, maybe even hundreds, but certainly not thousands of virtual firewalls per, you know, when there's a firewall at every host, right? Nor does the management plane scale, nor does the data plane scale. In fact, we have seen customers where, you know, it's taken them, you know, almost an hour to update their firewall rules every time there was an update, because, you know, that's not the architecture they've been built for, right? What's happening is you need security that's actually distributed out to every single workload, right? That's built as a distributed system. It's built into the infrastructure, and then has that awareness of the application, because that's the only way you can build this kind of a security policy, because it has to be application-centric, that policy. We operate on-prem, in the cloud, and we actually have some exciting service mesh technology. I can talk to that later on, around how you deal with SaaS services and PaaS. You know, you have a Lambda function, etc. So there's a lot of interesting places that this is taking the security architecture.
Fantastic. I do want to bring my co-host back in, because they're chomping at the bit here behind the scenes, and they have a bunch of questions for you. I want to start with Bam first. Bam?
So I think, you know, software-defined networking and network function virtualization in general in the enterprise has seen sort of slow adoption to date, right? It was the very hot new thing, you know, 4-ish years ago. I know VMware acquired NSX. So my first question, and then, you know, I'll come back with a follow-up, is how do you see network virtualization and software-defined networking enabling better security?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, last year we have this conference called FutureNet that we run at alongside VMworld, focused on networking. And, you know, we had this question out there to the audience that what are the use cases you care about for software-defined networking? And the number one reason came out to make my security better. So pretty much if we look at our customer base as well, you know, half the customers on average, and we've got thousands of customers, right? You know, as the sort of the leading software-defined networking and security solution as NSX, almost half the customers, their, you know, primary use case is security, east-west security.
So my follow-up question is going to be, do you see security helping to, you know, speed up that adoption? And certainly it seems like your answer is yes. Can you kind of give maybe some specific examples for our audience about those east-west security use cases that you mentioned, about, you know, things where, you know, function virtualization or software-defined networking enabled, you know, better security in those use cases?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally what we find with customers is, you know, they on the east-west, typically people will just deploy these firewalls at their zone boundaries, right? And so they're inspecting only a very small fraction of their traffic. What we enable them to do is move that, take that big hunky firewall and almost break it into like 1,000 little baby firewalls and push it out to every workload. So what that means is they no longer have to have that trade-off between operational complexity or simplicity and breadth and depth of security coverage. They get that absolute east-west visibility, absolute coverage, no blind spots on every single host with a little firewall sitting right there. And they can do all their access controls, that their advanced threat detection, and inspection out at, and that's the power of having a distributed model of the security. And I think that ties exactly to sort of some of the examples of lateral movement that I was talking to you about, because until you're inspecting all your traffic, it's going to be really hard for you to detect lateral movement if you're just applying security at some core zone boundaries.
You know, as I hear you talking about security, much of what you're saying sounds a lot like what people a little bit higher up on the stack are calling zero trust security. Is that a good explanation or a good label to apply to the way you see things going?
A very good question, Kurt. And actually, absolutely. We started the journey as the company that pioneered micro-segmentation, right? Back in 2013 when we released NSX. And micro-segmentation has kind of become synonymous with zero trust inside, networks, inside data centers. If you look at, I'll almost expand that thing to, if you look at VMware's broader portfolio, you probably have one of the most comprehensive zero trust portfolios out there, starting from the user with the secure access and identity capabilities that we have with our Workspace ONE digital workspace portfolio that includes, mobile device management, secure access, and so on, to endpoint protection with Carbon Black. So every single endpoint is secured. You have device posture that's based on its particular, its behavior and anomalous behavior, if so, to what we're doing with our SD-WAN portfolio by adding security out there and making the access to the data center and clouds more secure. And then finally, inside the data centers where, the NSX service-defined firewall comes in, giving you that micro-segmentation, internal firewalling, so that really you're pushing the workload on one end to the security, on one end to the user, and the other end to the workload, and actually ensuring that the access is, sort of exactly in that zero trust model. You can only access the resource that you have requested, and you can't move around there from there.
Well, as you're talking about moving around within this perimeter, to use another buzzword, it sounds like what I've heard people talking about with the software-defined perimeter, one that you can define as, going around both public and private clouds as well as on-prem. Is that a concept that also works here, that you're essentially defining your perimeter through software and then employing zero trust within and without?
The terms in my experience are somewhat similar, and it depends on which analyst you speak to for their definition, but exactly right. You're putting the security closest to the application and the workload, right? And that's what starts becoming that, software-defined perimeter as well. And as you know, our solution is completely software-based, and that's the other benefit of it, that it scales elastically with your workloads, right? It's, software-based security is not new, but scale out elastic security is incredibly powerful, because then it scales with the traffic, with the workloads linearly, without letting you fall into the inspection and throughput limitations that typical physical appliances make you hit up with.
Well, you started using some terms that are getting into the more classic cloud argument. So when we're talking about elastic in terms of workloads, how is VMware going to be working for the IT executive as they're trying to make decisions between what they host in their data center, what they get from a public cloud, what they host out on a private cloud. Are there tools, are there models, are there best practices for how to figure out where you're going to put your load when you have all of these options?
Yes. So, that's the question that our customers always ask us, Curtis, which is, how do I get that public cloud experience on premise, right? And that's really what we're bringing to our customers. The security that, the public cloud guys, they don't have dedicated appliances to do load balancing and firewalling and so on, right? They just give you, scale out software on x86. And that's what we have brought to the private cloud as well, so that it's highly automatable. It's one click. It runs with, it's API driven, intent-based, so that, you can automate it, et cetera. And so that equation shifts to give you that same agility on-premise versus on-cloud. And then it becomes a business decision for the company whether they believe they want to host their infrastructure internally or in the cloud. But in either scenario, we actually give you the single pane of management, because you could have, whether your workloads are in the cloud or on-premise, you have a single federation layer from where you can manage your security policies. And that's a really important thing that we've done with NSX and the firewall, is we've decoupled it from the ESX hypervisor, that NSX actually works seamlessly across multiple hypervisors, container workloads, bare metal workloads, and whether on-premise or in the cloud, even in or in like VMware cloud on AWS, which is our VMC service.
Thank you, Dhruv. Thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. We did give you the opportunity to maybe tell us a little bit more about where people and organizations can go to learn more about VMware and maybe some of the new offerings they have out there.
Yeah, sure. Obviously, we have all our stuff up on the website, but there's an interesting, exciting event coming up as well, Carbon Black Connect. Now that Carbon Black is part of the family, you'll actually hear a lot of the broad VMware security narrative out there. I think it's coming up in mid-May, so you should definitely check that out. It'll be a little bit more focused on the endpoint, but it will tell the whole VMware narrative. In terms of new stuff that's come out, Lou, we announced the IDS IPS functionality and the new capability. And that's really sort of made this a complete internal firewall, right? So you have layer 7 control, stateful layer 7 firewalling with advanced threat protection. And that's a really exciting new announcement, because it's almost probably the biggest innovation in the IDS space to bring that same distributed architecture out to IDS IPS, which has historically been one where, again, you use these custom bespoke hardware appliances with custom ASICs, with all the throughput and capacity challenges that exist with hardware approaches, and instead distributing that inspection out again to every single workload. So that's an exciting new announcement that we just made, and stay tuned. There's a lot more coming out, because this is an exciting space for us.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You said through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe, and you should stop resisting the urge to play us during your virtual social hours on Fridays here. But I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts, starting with our very own Mr. Brian McHenry, Global Solutions Architect over at F5 Networks. Bam, what's going on with you in the coming week, and where can people find you online and all of your work?
Well, you can follow me at BA McHenry on Twitter. And if you really want to catch up on what's going on with F5, we converted our customer event that was supposed to happen back in March in Orlando, down in Kurt's neck of the woods. Well, everything's gone virtual, and now we're launching our agility event virtually. So the week of May 12th, there'll be virtual keynotes and breakouts and demos. And then the week of June 9th, get excited, hands-on labs virtually, led by many of my solution architect and solutions engineering peers all over the world. We're going to use Zoom rooms. We're going to use a demo framework environment so you can get access to the same labs that I use every day to test out new F5 solutions. So head on over to f5.com/agility, sign up for breakout sessions in May, and sign up for labs that are coming up in June. So live and in living color, you'll have a virtual instructor right there next to you, help you work your way through a lab, learn how some of the new stuff works.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ben. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on with you for the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, they can find my work at Dark Reading and the edge of Dark Reading. As far as what I've got coming up, I've got a piece that will launch tomorrow on some of the secure remote access pieces that are being offered at no cost during the coronavirus. People might want to check that out. I've got a really interesting piece that I think is going to be popular with a lot of people. Next week, I have talked to a number of experts on election security and some of the issues that are changing, shifting, and now have to be taken into consideration with the coronavirus and what is likely to be the fallout of coronavirus that lasts through the November election.
Thanks, Kurt. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to this show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen. Catch up on your enterprise news each week. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twite. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, all the show notes, co-host information, guest information, and the links that we do about the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download and subscribe links. Support your show by getting an audio version, your video version, and your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications. It really is the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So definitely subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with sharing the gift of Twit with all of them. And if you have already subscribed, you can also, if you're available, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, Fridays, we do this show live, twit.tv. Come see how the show is run. Come see all the bloopers and behind the scenes, the banter that we have, all the fun we have here on Twit. Come check out live.twit.tv. Of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the fun chat room live as well. We have a great set of characters out there, irc.twit.tv. We have great discussion during the show, plus we have get some great conversations and questions out of the chat room, so definitely join there. Of course, if you can't join live and you subscribe to the show but you can't join live, you still want to be part of the conversation, hey, we have a great community out there as well. Twit.community, great website, great place to go to have a 24/7 discussion, technology, to talk to the guest host, talk to the co-host, talk about the shows, great set of topics, great set of place to come converse and have a really great community. So twit.community, go out there right now. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. That's right. There also, I post all my enterprise tidbits. Of course, I have really great conversations with people like you. And of course, I also post what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. And if you want to go out there right now and check dev.office.com, we have a great way of customizing your office to make it more productive for you and your organization. Also, don't forget, Microsoft is doing Microsoft Build here mid-May, May 19th to May 21st. Be ready to check out all that great online content about all the latest and greatest things that we're releasing, as well as ways to make your organization more productive. We also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we could not do this show without them. Could not do it. And we really thank for them for all their support. Also, thank everyone, all the engineers at Twit. Thank you so much for all your support. We definitely couldn't do this show without you. And also thank you to Mr. Brian Chi. He's behind the scenes. He's in the chat room here. He's lingering here. He can't get away from us at all. He's not only our co-host, he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings, the plannings for the show, and we really could not do the show without him. So thank you, Cheebert, for all your support. And of course, before we sign out, now we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Thank you so much for all your support, man. You're right on your toes today, man, especially with my network troubles. Thank you so much. Jeff, again, do you have any tidbits for people at home working remote?
At this point, continue to have a lot of patience. And, you know, this virus has taken a toll on all of us. So just be patient. be friendly, be kind to one another, especially when you're all in the same house together. You know, sometimes people can get on each other's nerves, but just remember, step aside for a second, take a breath, and everything will be good. And, you know, in a few months, we'll be back to doing all the things we enjoy doing outside.
I love that. Love that. Well, thank you, Jeff. And of course, thank you to our editor as well, Victor. You guys have been supporting us all along. We really appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.